Chapter 22 Mohammed's Arms Bazaar. In the fall of 1984, Charlie Wilson defeated his Republican opponent in the general election easily. Back in official Washington, and particularly on the seventh floor of Langley, Wilson was now perceived as a permanent fact of life in the Capitol, an unpredictable, rule-breaking maverick who was dangerous to cross. His most important House ally in the Afghan struggle hadn't been so lucky. Doc Long was defeated that year in spite of a $600,000 war chest, a major setback for Israel, which lost its most well-positioned and fanatically supportive congressional patron. For Wilson, it meant he would have to champion Zia's aid package on the Foreign Operations Subcommittee all by himself. It was a time of many transitions for Charlie. Joanne Herring had accepted a marriage proposal from a Houston millionaire, Lloyd Davis, a particularly suspicious Texan, who didn't approve of Wilson and insisted that his fiancée stop seeing him. Charlie wasn't invited to the wedding Joanne organized in Lyford Cay in the Bahamas. It was typically grand. She had everyone dress in white, and then she and her new husband left on safari for their honeymoon. All of a sudden, Charlie's muse was gone, but by then he was already swept up by the momentous forces that she had set in motion. She had pulled him out of his midlife crisis, taught him once again to believe in the special destiny that awaited him, inspired him, and then selected roles for him and Zia ul-Haq to play as champions of her freedom fighters. It wasn't easy for her to turn away from this shared crusade to rid the world of communist tyranny. Wilson, however, faced a new set of challenges for the game, which now had to be played against the Red Army. For that battle, his newfound friend from the CIA was a far more suitable companion. The two men had agreed to meet in Cairo the week before Thanksgiving to buy, or at least consider buying, anti-aircraft weapons that Field Marshal Mohammed Abu Razala had told Wilson would be perfect against the Russian gunships. The entire American entourage was to be received as the official guests of the defense minister, who had promised to let them review the Egyptian military's entire arsenal. True to his vow never to move in a Muslim land again without a good Christian girl by his side, Wilson had invited along Trish Wilson, the pretty blonde congressional secretary he'd had dinner with the night of his hit-and-run accident. The coincidence of their shared last names would be helpful when booking rooms in the stricter Muslim states. As usual, Charlie's traveling companion was not brought along for romance alone. Her principal role was to serve as the wide-eyed innocent witnessing and appreciating the astonishing status Wilson enjoyed in the worlds he was about to take her through. Traveling out of the United States for the first time in her life, Trish was in awe as they flew first class, then checked into a lavish suite at the Marriott, a colonial extravaganza built for Empress Eugenie in 1869 when she came to open the Suez Canal. The hotel was close to the pyramids, and as the days unfolded, Charlie's girl played her role perfectly. She saved every napkin, menu, bar of soap, and postcard, and even took photographs of their seats on the plane. Gust's trip was a bit more mundane. Unlike Charlie, he flew tourist class and checked in at the decidedly more pedestrian Ramses Hilton across town. Accompanying him were three tough and deeply skeptical paramilitary experts, Art Alper, the demolition and sabotage man from Technical Services, Nick Pratt, a Marine major on temporary duty with the PM branch, and his new military advisor, Mike Vickers. All three had warned Gust on the flight across the ocean that the gun Abu Razala was hawking, the ZSU-23, was even less suitable than the Erlikon. But Gust had explained that part of their mission was diplomatic. They had to give the weapon a chance, and if it didn't work, he needed them to back him up with explanations. The three military pros were all a bit tense since they knew full well that it was highly unusual to have a congressman pushing specific weapons for a covert program. The general assumption among them was that Wilson had a piece of the action. The Marine, Nick Pratt, who had just come back from test-firing the Erlikons in Switzerland, was a particularly straight-laced fellow who viewed Wilson with such distaste that he used an alias when introducing himself to the congressman, steadfastly refusing to reveal his real name. Avrakatos, meanwhile, was simply hoping against hope that Charlie would not fail the ethics test that lay ahead. But for now, the congressman, because of his relationship with the defense minister, was calling the shots. So Gust checked in with the station and set off across town to find Charlie. Avrakatos is an extremely type A personality. He can't bear to be trapped in traffic and actually drives on sidewalks to circumvent traffic jams. But that's not possible in Cairo, a city so overcrowded that an estimated 2 million people sleep in cemeteries. Stopped in hopeless gridlock, he cursed Wilson and the fates for causing him to be stuck in a seamy hotel all the way across town. By the time he arrived at Charlie's door, he was sweaty and stressed, which made Wilson's appearance even more startling. The congressman acted as if he were on the second week of a Riviera holiday. Gust recalls, "Charlie was in an open white shirt. Next to him was Trish in a white jumpsuit, and I said to myself, 'Motherfucker, look at this piece of ass. Some women can wear panties that show through their clothes in a way that drives you crazy.' This one brought out the Greek in me, and Charlie, of course, knew it." A more unsettling sight for Avrakatos was Dennis Neal, a lobbyist for the Egyptian Defense Ministry, standing behind Trish. It was more than Gust could believe. Neal might well have been Wilson's good friend, but it was hard not to conclude that he was walking into a corrupt bit of wheeling and dealing. How was he going to explain the presence of this particular American lobbyist, who seemed to be traveling with Wilson, to his three already suspicious colleagues? Gust tried to be diplomatic, explaining that there were rules he had to follow and he could not talk business with Neal in the room. When Charlie asked if Trish could stay, Gust responded, "I don't mind. I'll stare at her all night, but I won't be able to talk very much." So Neal was dismissed and Trish sent into the adjoining bedroom, where she immediately put her ear to the door. Once they were alone, Charlie told Gust that he had dined with the field marshal the night before and that everything was set up for the CIA's purchases. At that dinner, Mohammed and Charlie had placed rival fifths of Cutty Sark in front of each other and begun swapping jokes and matching drinks. It was a particularly exquisite exchange because the two had delightful business to transact. There was money to be made for Egypt, but, more important, a noble crusade to save the Afghans. To every weapon Charlie reported the agency was seeking, Mohammed responded, "No problem, we have exactly what you want." As Wilson recalls the dinner, "After the first fifth of scotch, I started telling Mohammed what we were going to do for him. We were going to save the Egyptian economy, modernize their ammunition factories, and together destroy the godless communists." Charlie Wilson's amazingly intimate relationship with Abu Razala was another remarkable coincidence that seemed to shape the buildup of the Afghan war. As defense minister, Abu Razala was one of America's most important partisans in the Middle East, decidedly pro-United States, and above all, not fundamentalist. In an economy and society so overloaded with corruption and bureaucracy that nothing worked, he had managed to create a separate world for the military, their own schools and housing, even their own farms. In its own way, Abu Razala's army, with its opportunity for advancement based on merit, was far more democratic than any other institution in Egyptian life. And from the standpoint of U.S. interests, it was his military alone that made it possible for Egypt to remain stubbornly pro-United States, in marked contrast to most other Arab countries, which tended to side with the Soviets. Mohammed was easily one of the most important men in Egypt, but no one in the U.S. government other than Charlie Wilson had such a raucous, intensely personal relationship with him. "We were soul brothers in every way," explains Wilson. "Pussy, whiskey, and conversation." They had met in Washington during the Camp David negotiations when Abu Razala, now a two-star general, was a military attaché. Wilson had been moved by Egypt's willingness to establish relations with Israel, and Mohammed was the man through whom he personalized it all. Beyond that, Abu Razala was a big drinker with a robust personality. Charlie invited the dashing young general to all his Washington parties. "He liked my women and wanted to know their friends," Charlie says. After Mohammed returned from Washington, Anwar Sadat gave him his third star and appointed him defense minister. Abu Razala had been on the parade reviewing stand when the Muslim Brotherhood gunned down Sadat in 1981. Mohammed was hit in the ear, and the television clips from the event show him taking charge of the counterattack, ordering the bodyguards into action against the assassins. By that time, Wilson had become a passionate congressional champion of Egyptian military and economic assistance, so important to Egypt that he had been invited as a guest of honor to that very parade, indeed to sit between Sadat and Abu Razala. Only a last-minute cancellation had spared Charlie this brush with death.